Be ready. Okay, so I'll, as a way of introducing our four gentlemen here, first we've got John Mose. John's a South Dakotan, and I learned this morning, Joe was bragging on you just a little bit, Region 7 NCBA Environmental Stewardship winner in 2019. Correct? Excellent. So Joe's runs a feedlot and has a cow-calf operation here in South Dakota. Just a sec. I'll go through and you'll get to speak in just a sec. Let's see. Trey Patterson's on the far end, Padlock Ranch in Wyoming, and manages their operations there. Tyler Braden, the King Ranch gentleman here in second in the hat from Kingsville, Texas. And John Maddox, Maddox Cattle Company, Juanita, Nebraska, right, John? Did I get it right? Excellent. So, John, if you'll go ahead and start, give us a little kind of introduction, and you can do it from there if you want to come up here on the podium. Either way is fine. So,
well, thank you for inviting me here to start with. We've got a cow-calf operation. We run about 300, 350 head of cows. We AI about 80 head of heifers every year. We got a feedlot. We go all the way to finish with these calves. We got a 2,000 head yard, all green, environmental, EPA qualified. We're permitted for that 2,000 head. With that, we take and started 25 years ago AI, and just starting with our heifers. Like last night, it was interesting to be here and listen to it. And we started with our heifers just because it was the easiest thing to do, synchronizing, and looked at the successful farmer. All the technologies, if you don't use technologies, you're going to lose it. So that's how we started. We started synchronizing heifers because it was the easiest thing to do. The cows were out on grass. Now we synchronize everything. We do the heifers the month of May. We start the cows the middle of June in three different bunches. And then we start calving the cows. The heifers calve the middle of February. We've got a monoslope barn that we calve in. And we take and get them calved. We've got the opportunity of a hoop barn to put them in when it's snowing out. The cows start the middle of March. And we group them as they calve. The first 50 head of cows go in a group. The next 100 head of cows go in a group. And then we finish up with the last 40, 50 head of cows go in a group. That way, when we come to start AIing in June, the farthest postpartum cows get bred. And we're on the cows. We're probably at 70, 75%. And then we just turn bulls in after we synchronize a seven-day seeder and go from there. As far as our genetics, we started 25 years ago on growth bulls. And what we found once we started marketing our own calves 6-7 years ago, once we got the feedlot built in 2007, we started seeing that there were certain bulls that when we get individual carcass data back on them, we weren't getting the marbling, we weren't getting the primes, the choice, CABs. We started looking for marbling and maternal traits for longevity in the herd. And we're to the point now where we've taken 128 head out this year already. It's just like clockwork the last 2-3 years. At 13 and a half months of age, the middle of April, we're taking them out. And the genetics are there. We're 98% choice or better, right at 50% CABs. And it's all because of the genetics. We're looking at the top of genetics. Now we're looking at marbling. We're looking at maternal traits. We're looking at terminal traits on some of the bulls this next couple of years. Once we've got the individual carcass data on these cattle, we can go back and look in which ones we want heifers out of. We haven't used much sex semen yet, but that's kind of our next point. We've worked with SDSU down here since 2003 on reproduction with George Perry. and with the genetics, and we just use bowls for cleanup. And we're getting to the point where we use more terminal bowls for cleanup because we don't keep them for replacements. So we're looking just at carcass on them more than anything right now. I guess that probably end up for right now.
Great. Great. Thanks, John. Tyler, if you'll go ahead. Tyler Braden, King Ranch.
Okay. Again, thank you for having me. My name's Tyler Braden. I oversee the cattle operations for King Ranch, which entails... We have 825,000 deeded acres in South Texas in four different divisions. We have 1,500 head purebred Santa Gertrudis herd, and we have a 16,000 head feed and background yard. The impetus of our purebred program is to create our own seed stock bulls for our commercial cattle operation. We breed our purebred herd to primarily Red Angus to create an F1 bull to then go out on our commercial cows, which we call the Super Cruise. Our commercial cow herd is comprised of about 23,000 breeding females, and they are comprised primarily of the Super Cruise breed today. In the 80s, King Ranch developed the Santa Cruise, which was half Santa Gertrudis, half Red Angus, and half Gelfie, and we've since done away with the Gelfie, primarily just due to logistics. The real legacy of King Ranch, you know, there's a lot of large cattle operations with a lot of history, very sizable, but for us, the real legacy of King Ranch is that it's bigger than any one generation. And so several decades ago, the family decided that the ranch would be family-owned and professionally managed. And it would be managed in such a way that it was economically and ecologically and therefore multi-generationally sustainable. And so our management model is predicated on profitability so that the operation can be multi-generationally sustainable for the family members. So from a genetic standpoint, the way we approach things is the profitability. So what is going to, and referencing Trey's talk yesterday, our model focuses heavily on cost control. You know, I believe there's a whole lot more opportunity typically to control cost than there is to add value. The problem is that model oftentimes isn't very sexy. It's not fun to show up to the coffee shop driving the 1980s Dodge that's beat up and brag to your buddies that your calves weighed 25 pounds less than theirs, but it costs you $300 less a head to do it. So our model tends to focus on how we can keep our costs, how we can control our costs. So, you know, as we look at some of the growth traits and some of the carcass traits, you know, genetic improvement isn't linear, like Trey was saying yesterday. You get to the point of diminishing returns, especially on your quantitative traits like fertility. If you're already breeding in the 90s, how much more opportunity is there to improve there? You know, Michael Janot reported last year here at BIF that as an industry, we're grading at 80% choice and prime, which you assume part of the industry's grading 40s and 50s, so that means the guys that are genetically progressive are breeding 90 are grading 90% plus. And so if you're already grading at 90% choice and prime, how much more opportunity is there to improve on that, and at what cost? Both actual costs in human capital and resources, financial costs, but also deleterious effects in other traits. And so we feel that our growth, Santa Gertrudis, are inherently growthy, and so we've done a lot to control our frame scores. Our carcass grading has dramatically improved over the last decade, and so what we feel is the biggest area of opportunity is extending the stayability of our commercial cows. You know, I'm with Trey. I'd love to sit up here and report that our average cow was 8-9 years old, but the truth is we're in the 5-6 age range. And so that's a huge area of focus for us in our operation. Also, I think the biggest area of opportunity for most cattlemen to add value is from a heterozygosity standpoint. And so within the confines of logistical challenges, We focus on trying to maximize the heterozygosity in our breeding program.
Well, I'm John Maddox from Juanita, Nebraska. I'm the fourth generation on our family's operation. My great-grandparents came out and homesteaded in 1886 and brought out Angus cows. We have run 2,500 cows on our ranch and have developed a maternal composite. And we are stressing fitness and convenience traits at the and not putting a lot of pressure and focus on the production traits. So we have this five-breed composite that is British in type. The makeup is 3/8 Red Angus, 1/4 Tarente, which isn't British, obviously, but maybe more British in type and size than a lot of the other European breeds. And then they're 1/8 South Devon, 1/8 Devon, and 1/8 Red Poll. And we manage that that composite herd as a purebred herd. We raise all of our own bulls, and have a pretty moderate level of production. Our cows weigh at preg check every year. We take a sample weight, old and young cows, but they'll weigh 11, and they are probably not. The steer calves are not well suited as calf feds, but they make an excellent steer to go to grass the following year. We just, on our way up here yesterday, my boys and I filmed for the video sale the big end of our steers, and they're going to sell on the for delivery in September, weighing 9 1/4 to 9 1/2. So they're not no growth, but they're certainly moderate growth and fit that kind of production scheme. So we focus on the fitness and convenience traits. Udders are very important. Docility, fleshing ability, calving ease, mothering ability. And that all is revolves around our view and our philosophy that if you could draw a perfect production function for a cow, that production function, that profit function, I should say profit function, not production function, that profit function for that cow is heavily, heavily driven by just that ability to raise of that cow to raise a calf. And I think we all remember in our studies the talking about fertility is twice as important as growth, and that growth is twice as important as the carcass traits. Now, I know some people may argue with that, but I think that insight about how important it is to try and make sure that that cow raises a calf, it really makes some of the other production traits trivial by comparison. And I think it's especially true when you have a set resource in that ranch and you have the ability to run 10% more cows if you have a 1,100-pound cow as opposed to having a 1,400-pound cow. Basic economics says if you're in a business like ranching that is a high overhead business, the way you attack that high overhead business is you try to run as many widgets through that business as possible and spread those high fixed costs on as many animals, as many widgets as possible. And so we feel like having those moderate-sized cows allows us to run more widgets, to have more numbers. And I think that it's really been proven. Stocking rate is one of the key drivers to profitability. And we feel like we can increase our numbers and run more cows by focusing more on these fitness and convenience traits and not trying to maximize growth, milk, all those other traits that are antagonistic to the most important trait, which is fertility.
Thanks, Trey. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to visit with you guys today. So Padlock Ranch is a family-owned integrated commercial cow-calf farm feedlot operation. The business is now into its fourth generation of ownership, going on fifth now with some little kids, that that has a focus on really how we have defined sustainability in our company is by being profitable, by being good at taking care of our natural resources. So stewardship and conservation of resources is very important. Supporting our local communities, being a good member of the community, having excellent people that are well-trained, and it really starts there. And then finally being an emblem for the ownership family. And so with that kind of goal of sustainability in mind, this the ranch was built over a number of years to expand up into the Crow Indian Reservation into Montana. So our operating area is between Sheridan, Wyoming, and Hardin, Montana. The cow-calf side of it is ran very extensively. Cows are asked to really make a living on their own with some modest supplementation and feeding at strategic times. So many cows are ran out year-round, weather-dependent somewhat, but we do ask those cows to make a living on native grass. And we are selecting, I think it's important to mention, selecting our own replacement heifers out of that cow herd. So the maternal traits become very important to us as we're watching genetics evolve over time. The farm and feedlot operation really go to support that extensive system where these calves are born a little later than typical. We'll calve in May and June. We do not calve anything through a calving barn. We do have a terminal cross program that we use on our heifers and a subset of our cows, but primarily with the heifers, that's based on calving ease, reduction in labor cost, and then a premium market for that calf crop off the heifers. But the mature cows as well, they calve out in large pastures unassisted. On mature cows, when you talk about calving, you know, we're riding through those cows a couple times a week. Heifers will get through them at least once a day. But there's no intensity to that scenario of calving, so those animals have to make a living on their own. And then we use those farm products to put weight on these lightweight calves in the fall. And so as Tyler indicated, we're not going to wean the heaviest calves in the fall of the year, but we're not selling calves in the fall of the year. We're making yearlings out of them with corn silage-based diets and retaining ownership on some of those and selling some of those. The retained ownership programs that we've been a part of are quality-based, are quality-grade-based. So we're very in tune to carcass quality, marbling in the cattle, and growth in the feedlot. And, you know, for our customers, for our yearling customers, many of those are repeat longtime customers. So we private treaty a lot of cattle that are sold as yearlings, and we want to be able to be at the top of the market when we contract those cattle because of the performance. And a big part of that is getting feedback, too. Is, you know, I've been on the road here for a little bit just trying to visit customers to get feedback on what they're seeing in our feeder cattle. But we're also, you know, while we're focused on that customer endpoint, which we all have somebody to sell to, and our market cows that we sell, and our feeder cattle that we sell, the fed cattle that we move, we have to be in tune to what our customers want. At the same time, when we're selecting all of our own replacement heifers, it's finding that balance with the maternal traits to allow us to continue to accomplish what we want to do outside of the feeding sector. And that extensive system, the cows have to be able to fit into that. One of the things that Wayne Foschold started before me, so I can't take credit for the idea, was using crossbred bulls. And what that has allowed us to do is to achieve the heterosis that we're after and continue to have a focus on range management. And so as we look at a fairly large and diverse landscape, by not having to focus on a particular breeding groups, it has allowed us to be able to put and take AUMs, if you will, in those different units to match what we've been given for rainfall and feed supply with consideration for some natural disasters such as fire, et cetera, and hold that cow herd together and really put an emphasis on range management. And so it's we talked a little bit about this yesterday for those of you in the symposium, but everything's integrated in this business. And if you look at anything from a singular standpoint, you're missing another aspect. And so being able to put a system together where we can obtain the heterosis that we want, the maternal traits that we want, the growth and carcass that we want, but not have to give up what we need to do to manage our rangeland and our labor and our cost all have to come in together. You know, there are some diseconomies of scale at being fairly large that just from a cost management standpoint, it become difficult to collect the kind of data that you would really love to have. And so we have to decide what information is important to us to collect. But because it's difficult, because of our calving situation and the way we're running cows in the summer, because it's difficult to tag calves to the individual cow, it's not impossible, but it would cost something, right, if you did that. That means we're having to put a lot of weight in the genetics that we're selecting to put into that system, because the sires become very, very important, as they are anyways, but especially when we're somewhat limited in the detail of data that we can collect on the female side. And then putting some pressure on those females to breed up early. You know, one of the things that we've been able to do in recent years, probably the last 6 years, 7 years or so, was to sort the cows that are bred in the last cycle of our calving season, sort those off by ultrasound. Those are ran as a separate herd. One thing that offers you is the opportunity to have a group that you can cull fairly easily if should you get in a drought situation. They have a lower NPV to you because they're later calving, they're lower pregnancy rates. But also from a selection standpoint, it's been possible then for us to identify those later born calves, and none of those are eligible as replacement heifers. And so we're just selecting replacements that are born early in our calving season and trying to build some of those traits that those animals carry with them into the herd. So crossbred breeding program, we really like to develop with our bull suppliers, you know, partnerships. We do raise some of our own bulls, and we do purchase some bulls. But those partnerships over time and communication become very, very important. And we can explain that a little further if we have some questions about that.
Great. All right, thanks, gentlemen. We'll go ahead now and open it for questions. So the grad students with microphones, if you'll start kind of roaming the crowd. Bert, we'll get to you next. We need one right up here in front. You'll be second. Go ahead, sir.
Is this on?
Yep.
Good. Trey, you alluded to it a little bit there at the end, but I think, in my opinion, one of the most challenging things that we do, and everybody's got a different idea how to do it, is how we go about selecting replacement heifers for our operations. I'd be curious, it sounds like all four of you retain all your own heifers. I'd be curious what your criteria are about going about that.
Great question. Thank you.
Yeah, so from a replacement heifer standpoint, we've been somewhat in an expansion mode the last few years, but I'll tell you what, the program that we were using for a period of time that I like the best was to run as many cattle out on rangeland in the wintertime as we could. Those cattle were light. These heifers, replacement heifers, these would be putting coming yearlings out on grass. Very modest supplementation, really not supplementing any more than we do the cow herd, putting some pressure on them that way. But in our May calving system, and this is an important point, you know, we're not breeding until July, so we'd get a lot of compensatory growth on those animals at the front of the year, but we put some pressure on them in the wintertime and then subjecting them to one round of artificial insemination and then just keep and not cleaning the cattle up. So we were selecting the ones that were bred early in the season and letting their ability to conceive to a round of AI finish that selection process. Now, we have not been religious about that over time, just because of some grass limitations and where we've been with numbers, a few fires, et cetera, that have limited that. But with that said, what we're really trying to do with the selection of those replacements is make sure that they are the ones that are born in the first two cycles of our season, and then really trying to put a visual appraisal on them that's really focused on moderate. You know, we're taking the bigger cattle out that are just going to make better feeder heifers, and we're feeding those. And obviously the lighter, younger end comes off, so it really becomes what is the middle-of-the-road kind of cattle, and then subjecting them to a fairly tight breeding season and selecting those that get bred in that season. One of the other criteria besides just being moderate in size is we're trying to keep as solid of coat color as we can. Our cattle are either solid black or solid red for the most part. And that seems to be fairly important to our customers.
We keep almost every heifer and expose her to the bull as a yearling. We keep 1,100 to 1,200 head of heifers. In our view, and this whole philosophy is heavily influenced by Rick Funston at the University of Nebraska and his heifer development studies. But we expose all of those heifers the first year because, quite frankly, we feel like those heifers that get bred in the first part of the breeding season are the most valuable heifers. We let the bulls make that decision, not us. And so we keep those heifers only that conceive in the first cycle. And we leave the bulls in longer, but we have heifers that we sell as bred heifers. It's been a terrific market for them. Bred at a different time than fits us. So one of the real benefits of keeping only those heifers that conceive in the first cycle, and by the way, our cows, we only allow two cycles of exposure of the ones we keep. Because of that, it's improved our fertility levels an enormous amount. Now, I know that the heritability of fertility is relatively low, but statistically, it helps your fertility on a herd basis dramatically because you never have any of those late calving heifers or late calving cows, which are the first ones to fall out the following year. So I really feel like that heifer selection is really done by the bull and her ability to get pregnant.
So I'm going to approach this question from a couple of different directions since we have both a purebred and a commercial operation. On the purebred side, we have some stringent selection criteria, probably very similar to everybody in the room. They go through a phenotype and EPD selection process that's pretty stringent. On the commercial side, however, we see the purebred side as the bottleneck to control the genetics. And so we aren't putting a whole lot of influence on that side. And kind of like Trey at the padlock, in the last several years, we've been in an expansion mode. So it's more about numbers than it is about anything. And South Texas it's an incredibly harsh environment. Today's heat index at home, I think, is 114 degrees. The parasites that we have to contend with are unbelievable. The biosecurity risk, being that close to Mexico, is substantial. So, and it's horrible yearling country. Cattle don't gain very well. Our average rainfall is 28 inches, but that may vary from 12 to 50 inches. And our annual carrying capacity may fluctuate by 10,000 AUs. And that volatility is incredibly difficult to manage. And so we can't do it very well with stockers because, one, performance risk, but anybody that's been in the stocker business the last several years probably wouldn't want to play on that level anyway. So we use our heifers as well as our stockers. And if we need to retain 3,000 head a year, we'll end up turning out 4,000, 4,500. The ones that breed early are the ones that fit our system. You know, King Ranch was the first ones to use the single-step model, then led SGBI to do it, and all other breeds have since adopted it. We use genomically enhanced EPDs. We're DNA testing 100% of our commercial heifers. And so we're not against technology by any means, and we fully embrace it. But there's some areas that just simple blocking and tackling and sticking to the basics is the best option. And it's a low-cost way to select the females that best fit our environment by selecting those ones that breed early. The ones that don't breed make good feeder animals for us, and then the ones that are bred late, we can usually sell at a premium for bred females that fit someone else's breeding season. As Trey alluded to, the PPM heifers, the piss poor management, that we probably didn't do a good enough job of getting them along to breed up, but they fit someone else's environment and production model very well, and then we sell at a premium.
I guess the thing that we started as far as on looking at replacements about 5-6 years ago, we ended up working with synchronizing and everything, and we AI'd in July, and we come back in October, and we had 10% opens on 60%. We had 6 open ones, and we started wondering, and they were confirmed bred in July. Trouble we have up here, we got a lot of coyotes around, and their fecal matter, they take and get out, and the cows eat that, and we get Neosporin, if everybody's heard of that. And it'll make the heifers abort. And how we found it was by doing research. And once we found that, we started bleeding all of our heifers when they come in the fall of the year, and all the high tigers on the Neosporin. That's how we've been sorting our heifers the last 3-4 years. And the year that we didn't bleed and sort, we had 35% bred AI. The last 3 years, we've been in the 60s, synchronizing it in AI. And so we put them in the feedlot, don't affect them any other way than that. And that's how we've been keeping our heifers back. And then we keep our top AI'd heifers to start with, and then we'll keep the first bull bred ones. Otherwise, the later ones just go in the feed yard. But then we'll take and synchronize them heifers, AI. The last 2 years, we've been going at 21 days, putting GNRH in them at day 28, and then regrouping them at day 28 in AI in the second time, and then whatever isn't bred, they go down the road. They get fattened. Which hasn't hurt us a bit, because those have been going out at $2,000 fat with a niche market without implants in. So that's what we've been doing with our heifers the last couple of years. But the biggest thing is we've got coyote problem up here, and we've got prairie potholes around in our pastures, and them coyotes are around there with all the wildlife picking up and leaving their fecal matter, and then them heifers pick that up. And we found by bleeding our heifers, we're getting the Neosporin under control on our cows.
Yeah, great. One of the things that you all probably caught this, but that really adds to your risk management system is that each of you has a strategy to keep early born heifers and early bred heifers as replacements, and then you've diversified your marketing stream, right? So you've got another spot, managed risk in terms of marketing window, value-add heifers, sell-bred heifers. So one of the secrets, fertility is really important, but how you manage the capture of value of culls, per se, plays a key role in each of your operations. So that's a really good point to bring out. Bert, I promise you is the next question. So Bert Rutherford, go ahead.
Where and how, or maybe the question is, does or does not, do or do not, genomics and DNA profiling fit and work in your operations?
Question.
We haven't used it much. We started with SDSU about 6-7 years ago when it first come out, and they've done part of it. Our cows were all tested, and we got the information. They're trying to figure out with the Angus Association and grouping that all together. We haven't used it as much right now, but in the future we'll probably start using it a little more, just seeing what traits we want as far as whether it's maternal or a terminal part of it as far as carcass and stuff, to keep our cow size. Our cows are probably some of the bigger ones up here, but we're short on pasture up in this area, up in South Dakota, where we're at, northeast South Dakota. So we got corn stalks for the cows to run on until December, until the snow gets too deep, and then from there we got to feed them. We can take and raise our feed cheaper. Then we can take and find something to put them on as far as the crop ground is too spendy. So we can put an acre of corn in or feed stuff, and with our byproducts, with the ethanol plants around and everything, we can feed them cows cheaper on a ration than we can have the acres of ground to put them on. So that's part of our whole operation there.
Yeah, so genomics do play a big role in what we do. In the early 2000s, King Ranch developed their own within-herd EPD system. And then, as I stated earlier, we were the first to adopt a single-step model, and then subsequently the genomically enhanced EPD. So today we have over 8,500 genotypes on file with our in-herd database. Every one of our purebred animals are DNA tested and have the intentions to continue doing so. Obviously, the accuracy of our EPDs wouldn't be where they are without genomically enhanced EPDs. And as I was talking about earlier, the genetic improvement is not linear. I equate it to losing weight. You know, the first 50% is pretty easy. The next 25% is hard. The next 10% is really hard. And the last 5% is dang near impossible, right? And genetic improvement's a lot the same. And so to continue your rate of improvement, at some point you're going to have to adapt new tools or new strategies. And so genomics is that step for us. On the commercial side, we're DNA testing 12K on 100% of our replacement females. And this is something I want to be careful sharing with the room, because I'm not suggesting that it fits everybody. And in most operations, I would advise against it. And I agree with Trey that size has some diseconomies of scale. But in this instance, it has an economy of scale for us. We're able to have a price point that makes that work just on sheer volume. And really, the reason that we're doing it is because of the fertility. You know, if you track stability in the cow, and especially if you use it as a Boolean trait, 0 or 1, by the time that cow gets to be 10, 12 years old, and you're punishing all her contemporary groups that have fallen out over the years with zeros, you don't know which ones are your really, really good ones until they're 8, 9, 10, 12 years old, which at that point, you're essentially too late. And so by having the genomics on all those and being able to go back to a sire, a dam, and the markers on them will allow us to identify some of the most fertile, and feed that back into our database system will allow us to identify the most fertile animals. And we couldn't do that at the same level without the genomics.
Bert, we don't even have a modern quantitative genetics, let alone a genomics component. And I would love to have a sophisticated program like the King Ranch does, but I'm afraid that our genetic program is more biblical in its nature. It's just, I can't quote you the verse, but it goes back to like begets like.
Yeah, that's good.
Follow that, Trey. Go ahead.
Well, ours is New Testament anyway.
Well played.
We have recently initiated a program to use genomic testing in some of our home raised bulls in selection of those. It's not used. We haven't used it extensively, but we are beginning to use the technology.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. Next question. Craig?
So Mark talked about C-stock where we were skipping, or we were speeding up the generation interval. How do you guys feel about buying bulls that we're doing that with, and then relying on genomics for some of the longevity stuff that Tyler talked about?
Well, I think from our perspective, you know, that makes a lot of sense, and I think that's a great use of that technology would be in our bull suppliers and helping us to determine those traits that are important for us, that are hard and long to measure. I think there's going to be real application of that moving forward. So in terms of how open we are to that technology and continued or enhanced use of that kind of technology in selection, especially working with our supplying partners, I think it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think it comes back to a cost-benefit analysis. If all technology that can improve your generation intervals, that's the Achilles heel for the cattle industry compared to pork upholstery, right, is not being able to turn our generation intervals. And so it's obviously a huge advantage as long as the technology is cost-effective.
I guess when you start looking back when I started this whole as far as if we don't use technology, we're not going to gain technology and genomics. We keep an open mind and look at what's coming. I think it's all good. We got to kind of weed out the good from the bad, and it's all going to work out. If we don't use technology, we're going to be behind on everybody, and I think we're all kind of on that same page.
Great. Who's got the next question for this group? Somebody? Oh, there you go. Glenn Klippenstein. You got a microphone headed your way or just behind you there, Glenn.
I don't know that I need one.
You've never been accused of being quiet, have you?
Following up on the longevity, how important is longevity and what is technology that emphasizes many other traits other than longevity? How is that impacting that and convenience traits?
I guess with our herd, when we started 15, 16 years ago working, we were looking at just making sure we had enough pregnant cows to keep in business. Anymore, it seemed like with the synchronized and the genetics that we have nowadays, if you use quality genetics, seed stock, whether it's AI or bull, it just picks it up naturally. It's there. And your longevity comes right with it, is what I've seen in our herd. And like I said, when we started, it seemed like we were trying to just make sure they were bred, and we didn't care if they had docility. Now, docility, udders, feet and legs, and the maternal side is there too. So the longevity comes with it if you have the quality there, is what I've seen.
So I could speak on this for quite some time. I'm pretty passionate about it. The best way to highlight it, I think, is you look at the cows that are back to controlling cost. So typically your highest costs are feed, labor, and depreciation, right? Depreciation of both your rolling stock, your permanent improvements, and cow depreciation both. So the cows that are completely depreciated out are the most profitable cows on the ranch. And so, and as you, the probability that a cow will stay in the herd until 7, 8, 9 years old, again, is not linear, right? Once she gets to be bred as a second calf heifer, it's exponential at that point, right? So back to Trey's point, you can feed a heifer a little bit, afford to, maybe not an annualized P&L basis, but over her lifetime on an NPV basis. And so longevity is imperative in commercial cow-calf operations, I think. You know, and on our internal economic relevant trait modeling, it actually, fertility comes out to be about 14.5 to 1 on carcass, whereas growth is 10.5 to 1 on carcass. Now, that is a straight analytic economic analysis. It does not take into consideration heritability, or heterosis in there. So once you take those into consideration and go through the entire economic modeling, it comes out to about 3 to 3 to 1 for us. Now, you can't extrapolate that across all operations because genetic improvement, again, is not linear. So it depends on where on the spectrum you're at and where the opportunities are to make improvements for various traits, right? But I'm trying to highlight the point that fertility and stability, longevity in the herd, there is nothing that's a higher leverage point for controlling cost.
I guess I would say longevity reminds me of the phrase and the most important phrase in the English language. There's four words, up to a point. And I think the longevity for us, longevity is extremely important up to a point. But it runs right into the economics of that cow herd. And for us, we feel like we have a very cheap way of developing a heifer and have a high replacement rate, which allows us to go into that cow herd and sell all of our 7 and 8 year old cows before they depreciate. One of the huge, huge costs of a cow herd is that annual depreciation of those cows that are losing value on your balance sheet when they depreciate from a running age cow worth $1,700 to an 8, 9 year old cow that's worth $800 or $900. So we try to keep a high replacement rate and then harvest those cows before that large depreciation happens. And we have found an excellent market as long as we've got them all straightened up and a really good set of running age productive cows that haven't really depreciated out their value. So, boy, if we can keep that longevity up until their time that we can sell them, that's very important. For us to keep a cow around till she's 10 or 11 years of age, the depreciation costs overwhelm that benefit of having that lower replacement rate.
Well, I think this issue of our focus on certain traits so heavily in the industry and those that are easy for us to identify and measure that have higher heritability have certainly led us as a industry in general down a pathway with less emphasis on maternal. And I think that we're very aware of that. And, we certainly monitor our production traits. You know, it's really pregnancy rate and weaning rate, those things that go right to the bottom line. And so my concern with that, or why we want to pay a lot of attention to that, is I think once we're starting to see that taper, where you're starting to see those traits taper off, you are way behind the eight ball because of the generation interval to change that in your cow herd. And so what do most people do? They change their system to fit the cow rather than focus back on the cow herd. And so I think we just have to be paying constant attention that if we're having to feed more or change our system. Now, we're in a different environment than some of you. We're in a semi-arid, pretty extensive environment. But if we're seeing over time to maintain those production numbers that we feel like are optimal for profitability, then we're heading down the wrong pathway. So we're really trying to couple a cost that we're putting into these animals with these production traits to monitor that. And then we do want to use genomic information to be out in front of that. Because like I said, once you've gone down that path, it's going to take a long time to fix it. Or it's going to be expensive to fix it. I think that's where we have to pay a lot of attention to that from a maternal standpoint. Now, maybe one of the best things that you can have happen, though, kind of back to where we started, would be to have as right on the very front end with your heifers is not to have longevity. Weed out the ones that don't breed in the system that you put them in early. That doesn't negate at all the importance of the sires that you're putting back into your herd. It's still critically important. But maybe getting rid of those cattle as a long yearling rather than as a 3 year old can have a tremendous impact, I think, on building that into your herd.
Right. Find the failures sooner. Yep. Great. Well, we've used up the time. I appreciate everybody's attentiveness and good focused questions for the group. Let's give these gentlemen a nice round of applause.